Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. One of the last things you need to worry about if you or a loved one needs expensive, durable medical equipment or certain medical supplies is out-of-pocket cost. So to open the show today, we want to introduce you to the founder of Wheel It Forward, an innovative Fairfield County nonprofit that provides a durable medical equipment lending library and more, all at no direct cost to you. Then we're going to reconnect with our community partners at Ableus, which is celebrating the opening of their first medical model residential home in Fairfield County for adults with complex medical needs and developmental disabilities. Tune in and hear about the journey toward completion of this fully accessible residence and more. And we're going to close circling back, as promised, with our friends at the New England Rural Health Association. We'll recap the recent conference, which was held here in Connecticut, and learn about how our state may benefit from the organization's recently launched Rural Health Transformation Program. Check it out right after this important reminder for veterans and those who know them. Veterans Saves is a program of America Saves and sister program to Military Saves. Their mission is to increase the financial confidence and well-being of American veterans and transitioning service members so that they can save successfully, reduce their debt, and build wealth. You can make a pledge to yourself and create a simple savings plan that works. Learn more and start saving today by visiting veteransaves.org. So as we mentioned in the introduction, our first guest this morning is Elliot Sloyer, who is co-founder of Wheel It Forward. And first of all, I need to say full disclosure that I had the opportunity to take advantage of their services on behalf of a loved one who needed a piece of durable medical equipment, but was a little bit financially pressed and was able to get it through Wheel It Forward. And their vision is to change the way people from all backgrounds think about the availability, use, and reuse of durable medical equipment, which thereby improves quality of life. It saves hundreds of millions of dollars, and it keeps billions of pounds of durable medical equipment and related products out of landfills. So really a trifold mission here, Elliot, and I want to thank you so much, not only for being on the program this morning, but for bringing this critical service to us here in Western Connecticut.
John, thank you so much, and thanks for helping shine a light on our new kind of community library.
Right. So one of the most important things people need to know is, as they're listening to our conversation, is, you know, you guys do one big fundraiser every year, and that's the end of the year fund drive that's coming up shortly. And we're going to let people know that they can go to wheelitforwardusa.org to find out more and find out where they can make their donations. And we'll talk a little bit more about how you apply and how much of that donation in terms of proportion goes back to servicing the agency, because you guys really are volunteer driven, which is awesome, and also gives a lot of people who may not be able to make a donation or who have been touched by your services or seen the incredible benefits of them can come to volunteer. So really excited to talk about that. But first, let's talk a little bit more about you. Tell me a little bit about your background and how you discovered this cause and this need to fill.
Sure. Thank you. So I have a Wall Street background. I spent about 25 years on Wall Street, got involved in some startups. Through happenstance, I was asked to chaperone an eighth grade trip from a local school that sends about 30 students a year to Israel. And while I was honored to be asked, I'm a little bit risk averse and was concerned that that would be a pretty risky venture, you know, traveling around the Middle East with 13-year-olds. Mm. And I told them I was honored to be asked, find somebody else. They did find somebody else, but 2 weeks beforehand, that person backed out, whoever it was. And my wife told me I needed to go. Mm. And the inspiration for this idea was an organization that they took the students to, a not-for-profit called Yad Sarah. It's existed for 40 years. Whether you're Jewish, Muslim, or Christian in Israel, whether you are rich or poor, and you have a need for medical equipment, either you've injured yourself, you're getting recovering from a surgery, you're almost 100% likely to borrow it from them. And when I saw that, I said, wow, that is a really great idea. I had never had experience with durable medical equipment. Thankfully, I'd never needed it. But I came back here to America, did a very deep dive on what's going on here. And we, you know, in our blessed country, are barely scratching the surface on the opportunity that exists here.
Mm. So let's get down to terminology. When you say durable medical equipment, give folks an idea of the range of stuff that Wheel It Forward is able to make available to those who may need it.
Sure. So we look at durable medical equipment as roughly 10 categories of equipment. They are items that are durable that can last for 5 years or more. And they are the basics of what people need to help them recover at home or stay safe at home. So when we say that, we think things like wheelchairs, knee scooters, shower chairs, walkers, rollators, canes, commodes, other equipment that help people stay safe at home. And the general consensus is that this equipment can last, as I mentioned, for over 5 years, but it's typically used for only 4 months. And the question is, what's happening to it from there? And I think we all know, because it ends up in our garages, it ends up in our basements or in a closet, and most often it ends up in a landfill, because when people no longer need this type of equipment, they want it out of their lives. And there needs to be a place for it to go where people who are in need can get equipment that is sanitized, inspected, and in excellent condition. And on the other side of the equation, when people have this stuff that's no longer needed, for example, Wheel It Forward is a wonderful resource where they know they can easily bring it to us, and it will benefit other people in the community.
Mm. You make such an important point, Elliot, in regards to kind of the situation and sort of the way we think of things here in the U.S. in terms of, you know, we have a loved one, as you mentioned, most folks only typically need this stuff for a few months, whether it is because they have been assigned it or prescribed it as a course of recovery from a temporary injury, or sadly, because individuals are in an end of life cycle. And particularly, you know, if you've, you know, broken your ankle and you need a knee scooter, or, you know, you have a situation where you know, maybe had a hip replacement, and you need a wheelchair for a few weeks. You know, once you're healed, you don't want to be reminded of that yes. Recovery. So get it out of my sight. More seriously, those who have to acquire this equipment at the end of life, when they pass, relatives and loved ones or others who are caring for them, likewise, it's a reminder of the sadness and the trauma that they experience, and they just want it out. And the way that typically it goes out into the trash and into landfills. I mean, you say it well on your website. Billions of pounds of this stuff goes into landfills, and you know, they don't call it durable for nothing. So it has you know, a million year half life in a landfill, right?
Yes. So one of our board members mentioned once that, you know, it's called durable medical equipment, but unfortunately, historically, the way we've treated this type of equipment in America is it's disposable, right? And it's really durable, and there is no reason why something can't be sanitized, inspected, and lent out again, and not just again, literally again and again and again, if you have the proper setup to handle that. Mm. And one of the things we're doing that's unique in this space, there are several things that we're doing that's unique, but one of them is that we're building this out to scale. So across America, this industry, I'll put that in quotes, and obviously it's a not-for-profit industry where people are doing wonderful things. They're helping people. But it's typically referred to as a loan closet, which is a term we don't like. And that is the lens through which this industry has been built out over the last 100 years. A bunch of people want to do good at a church, at a firehouse, sometimes literally on their front lawn. They'll open a loan closet. And the problem with that is they're not using technology, right? So they're not learning from their experiences and figuring out how they could maximize the benefit. Mm. And they also don't have enough space. So this is largely a storage and logistics problem to solve. These items that I mentioned before, they're kind of quite large. Mm. And what happens is if you have them in literally a closet, that closet fills up pretty quickly. And especially if people don't know about it, they've never heard of this concept, stuff goes in, but it doesn't come out. Mm-hmm. We are looking through this through a different lens, through the lens of a community library built to scale that uses technology that we have created and developed in systems and processes. And the idea is to be able to take advantage of the massive amounts of this equipment that's out there, and also to help the even greater number of people who need this equipment. So for example, when a person needs one piece of equipment, they likely need three or four pieces of equipment because there's something going on. If you're having knee replacement, you not only probably need a shower seat with backs and arms, but you probably need a walker for the rehab. You might need a cane. You might need an ice machine. You might need a commode just to create arms around a toilet. Mm-hmm. And we always have those things. And that is unique across America in terms of what's been going on in this space.
Two things. First is the resistance. We talked earlier about how easy it is for us Americans to use the other D, the disposal word, instead of the durable word. But yes. The aversion or the mental space that people are in, where they may be averse to taking on equipment like this that's already been used by someone else. But you folks at Wheel It Forward really, really have a sanitizing system by which virtually every piece of equipment you take in is made new again.
Yes. So we talk internally, and I've been fortunate to be able to stay at some very nice hotels in my life. One hotel that I've never stayed at is a Four Seasons hotel. And one day I hope to make it to a Four Seasons hotel. Mm-hmm. But one thing to keep in mind, and we tell this to people, is the night before you got to that Four Seasons hotel, somebody else was drooling into that pillow and somebody else was using that bathroom. And the truth is when you go there, you have no problem with that because you know that they have processes and procedures to sanitize that bathroom area and to take care of the pillow situation in whatever way they do. And so in reality, although it sounds like people might be averse to it, they're already doing it. And one of the discussions we had as a board before we started this about 5 years ago, it was just the question of, would somebody who could borrow this who could afford this equipment, would somebody who could afford it borrow it from us instead? And we've had very few disagreements. Some people in that question said, Elliot, if somebody can afford their own commode, which might cost $75, They're never going to borrow one from you. And other people disagreed, and we agreed that we would find out together, right, once we started this. Mm-hmm. And about a year into the project, somebody who I know, is not a friend of mine, but somebody who I know who's the CFO of a large financial firm, I saw walking out of Wheel of Forward, and he had a toilet riser seat under his arm. And his name was Bob. And I said, Bob, how are you doing? And he said, you know, I was in a biking accident and I'm having some hip surgery. And I just thought I would benefit from one of these things. And I said, you know, that's great. We wish you a speedy recovery. If you need anything else, let us know. And for me, that was the tell, right? Bob could have easily afforded a $30 or $40 toilet riser seat that allows you to not have to sit down so far when you're having hip issues. And so there's no stigma in going to a book library. All of us use our local libraries all the time. And our goal is the same for this venture, and really just to make it part of the community. Aspirationally, our team has a simple dream, which is that one day across America, there'll be two kinds of libraries. One library that lends out books. You already know where it is. It's built to scale. It uses technology. It has relationships with other libraries in the area. And the second library will lend out durable medical equipment. It will also be built to scale. Everybody will know about it, and it will become ubiquitous. And the reason we think that's important is because way more of us, right, like literally 100% of us, 100% of our families, at some point in our lives will need durable medical equipment for either an injury or recuperation or an operation, whatever it is. So we're hoping that people will root for us to succeed, if for no other reason, that they will need us one day. We're touching about 2% of the greater Fairfield County population every year right now. That's roughly, in our area, that's about 8,000 families who will either borrow or donate equipment to our library every year. And we are scratching the surface, but we are not deeply scratching the surface.
Well, I have to say, as a first-time user of Wheel It Forward, going through the experience of borrowing from was quick, seamless, friendly, and you know, just a pleasure. When you think of both the potential savings that could be applied to other more high priority needs in terms of a care situation, but also the fact that what was borrowed did not get tossed out into a landfill. So it's a good feeling to borrow from Wheel It Forward. But in the last couple of minutes that we have from you, we want to let people know, if they want to learn more about how to recycle durable medical equipment and other supplies that they have so other folks can utilize it, or if they need it, they can go to wheelitforwardusa.org to learn more and go to one of the locations in Fairfield County that you've established, and hopefully that will be a growing network of locations over the coming years. Thanks to the support of people who are doing something a little bit different, and that is giving you guys some much needed funding. You guys do a great job in making sure you're maximizing every dollar toward the end cause, right?
Sure. So what we've learned and experienced over the last few years is that literally for every dollar we spend, and there are lots of startup costs and technology startup costs and building out new branch costs, but in total, for every dollar that we spend, we're lending out about $3 worth of equipment. So on an economic perspective, if you know, if you had a CEO of a for-profit company and you told them that on your whole organization, you can spend a dollar, and in return, your return on investment, you're going to get $3 in profits. You know, they would tell you, you know, you never went to business school. That just can't be possible. So, but that is the economics of it. Obviously, I'm a volunteer. We are largely volunteers, and it kind of works. We have probably about 30 or 40 volunteers with special needs who come into our branches every week, who help us sanitize equipment, help us move around inventory. We have wonderful volunteers from local seniors men's club, people with tremendous skills in different areas who help us out as well. The other thing I'll mention, if people are listening who are outside of Connecticut, is that we launched a website last year, 2024, called gotdme.org. So it's gotdme.org. And the reason is from pretty much day one, people from all over the country stumble upon our website, which is strange because we're very local right now, and they want to know places where they could borrow or donate equipment. And so we had our team put together GotDME to be a national directory for all the small places that exist, because 75% of them or more don't even have their own websites, right? They'll have a mention on somebody else's website.
Or they're on social,
Yeah. And we got a nice shout out from an influencer in the physical therapy area about at the beginning of this year. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the day, that day, the American Cancer Society had reached out to us. The National MS Society reached out to us. AARP reached out to us and said, can we put a link to this resource on our website, on the resource pages.
That's great.
And it proved to us that that was a resource that didn't exist. That website gets about 1,200 unique visitors every week. So it's close to, 4,000 or 5,000 every month from people all over the country. Mm. And the other positive to GotDME for us internally, obviously we just want to point people in the right direction, is we know where these places are. And now we know where these places aren't. So, for example, on Long Island in New York, we know there's virtually nothing in Westchester County, which abuts Connecticut and Fairfield County. There is virtually nothing. So in Israel, Yad Sera, which I mentioned, has 100 locations in a country the size of New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And what we've discovered through the data of GotDME is that there are not 100 locations in our blessed country, which is 99 times the size, that lend out volume, that are built to scale. And so that's really the opportunity ahead to meaningfully improve the quality of people's lives, measurably save us all money. And lastly, as you mentioned, this is green. We're keeping, hundreds of thousands of pounds out of landfills every year right now, and we're just getting started. And last year, we kept, based on our calculations, 700 tons of carbon out of the atmosphere, based on reuse and recycling.
Very good. Well, we encourage people to support this organization through donations, because you can make donations go a great distance, but also, once again, you are at the service of individuals who may need durable medical equipment to loan, as well as some other medical supplies for those who want to donate or to volunteer. All the information you need is on wheelitforwardusa.org. We're so pleased to be able to spend some time chatting with Elliot Sloyer, who is the founder of Wheel It Forward here in Connecticut, creating a template and operating a branded lending library where people who need durable medical equipment can borrow it, and where people who have lightly used DME can conveniently donate it to benefit others and the environment. WheelItForwardUSA.org. Elliot, thank you so much for the conversation this morning, and we will talk to you again. Well, as we said in our introduction, we're circling back with Amy Montemuro. She is with Ableist, celebrating 75 plus years of providing individuals with developmental disabilities and their families in Fairfield County with services, supports, and advocacy for building able lives and strong communities. Exciting times down at Ableist, thanks to the recent grand opening of their medical model home in Stamford. They've also got a holiday program we're going to talk with Amy me about. But before we get into that, we want to remind you about another important issue that is happening here in Connecticut, and that is pet overpopulation. And to respond to that, the Connecticut Department of Agriculture is now accepting applications for the Animal Population Control Program's low-income spay and neuter program. Eligible Connecticut residents can apply for assistance with spaying or neutering a dog or cat that they own. All applicants must be submitted online, and upon approval, vouchers will be issued electronically for up to two pets on a first-come, first-served basis out of the available funds. If you want to connect to their online portal to apply now, you can visit apcp.ct.gov. All right, Amy, welcome again to the program. We appreciate the good work on your behalf to stay in touch and keep us abreast of all the new and exciting news that's going on at Ableis. So the big news that you hinted was coming the last time we talked was the establishment of this medical model home in Stamford. The ribbon cutting happened just days ago, practically. Why don't we start at the beginning of the dream to establish this facility down in Stamford?
Sure. Well, Ableis is always looking at the needs of our community and working with our state to develop lifelong supports for individuals as they're aging and their needs are changing. And our organization has been pretty creative in developing independent living models and community living arrangements and the different models that the state provides for us to develop to support our community. And we started to see an increase in the needs of individuals with complex medical needs. And, you know, for the people that we're supporting, we don't want to see them in nursing care facilities, especially when they're in their 20s. So we worked with our state through an RFP process to develop a home that would be accessible where individuals can age in place, be provided with dignity and the care they need with nursing staff, other employees that have a higher level of medical experience to be able to provide the 24-hour care that these individuals will need.
So how do you go about even, you know, starting a project like this?
Yeah, Ableis, we're celebrating 75 years next year. So we have a longstanding relationship with the Department of Developmental Services in the state of Connecticut, where we make sure that they're aware of our community members that are aging, that have parents that are soon not going to be able to take care of their children. And we just continue to work directly with them to make sure that the individuals that are in our community are going to be able to be supported and what environment will be best for them. So it really is a partnership with our organization and the state of Connecticut to make sure that we are really providing, you know, creative housing models that really meet each person where they are, where they're community-based, where we can provide them with the least restrictive environment so they can be as independent as possible. It really is, you know, a team effort with our organization and our state and the Department of Developmental Services.
Tell us how, because you've got dozens of locations in the lower Fairfield County area for your clients, and how does the medical model home differ from a number of the other facilities that you folks operate?
Oh, it's a great question, because right now we're really looking to make sure that all of the homes that we have are people are able to age in place. So making sure they're fully accessible and they have all the adaptive equipment that they need. This really focuses on the staffing level for these individuals. Each, you know, typically the requirements are not as involved medically for the other homes where a direct support professional, we are able to easily train and help people and support them living in their own home. This model, we need to have a registered nurse a licensed practical nurse to help individuals with some, you know, medical procedures that are done daily that are, you know, individuals require. So it really, the accessibility is similar to in many homes that we operate. It is the level of staffing and the requirements of their education that differs this program from others.
And this is designed to be a communal situation for a number of your clients.
Yes, this has, well, there are six individuals that live there. It's a beautiful home. It looks just like any other home in the neighborhood. In addition to it being accessible, there's also lifts that are in bedrooms that carry out to the bathrooms to make sure that individuals are safe and that they transition easier from using a wheelchair to a shower chair. Staff, you know, are safe and they don't get hurt with transitioning and transferring individuals. So all of the, you know, equipment that we have placed in the home have, you know, buttons and television sets that go up and down, and making sure that each person can access the home and participate in their activities of daily living independently. And we just look as, you know, they're going through their day, what can we do each day to make them more independent? What else can we provide in this home to help them so that they feel good about what they're doing and taking care of themselves as much as they possibly can?
And it appears from the information I have, it also accommodates, you know, the socialization aspect that is so important. There's, you know, gathering places in the home where any or all of the residents can hang out and, you know, relax.
Absolutely. There's common, beautiful common areas, just like any of us have in our own homes, where they can be together. And our organization provides a large activities and recreation program. So if there are other things that we could do, we opened up the Cohen Able Advancement Center in January, where we have weekly activities, karaoke and bingo and, anything you could possibly think of where to keep people engaged. So they're in their own home, and we certainly make sure that people are involved in the community, and we provide individualized activities for the residents to participate in.
What I love to hear from you, Amy, is the view through your eyes as you interact with and watch the individuals who are stepping into a new world of, you know, self-sustainability, independence. Without getting into deep into specifics, tell us about what you see and have seen from the residents who have entered your new medical model home in Stamford.
Well, for one individual who's living there, he calls it the fun house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for parents, this next, you know, chapter in their lives where they've taken care of their kids for all these years. And, you know, our organization is taking over that daily care, it's difficult for them, more difficult for the parents than it is for their children, because we could see them blossoming and being so excited to, you know, participate in their, you know, figuring, you know, to making their own meal. And a lot of times parents don't realize it, but they do so much for their kids because they just feel that they need to, so that we see the smiles. It's my home. You know, individuals see their siblings moving on to going to college and getting their own apartment and getting married. And for a lot of the people we're supporting, that may not happen. And to see them, this is my home, my next step, my next chapter. Look at what I can do and how I can participate. And, you know, ableist is, you know, our thought in this home was, it started from an individual that we supported from our Birth to Three program. And there wasn't any model that there, you know, was around for us to provide this high level of medical care. And we partnered with the state just for one person. We knew there would be more people that needed it. But to see him and his family now able to not worry about what happens to their child when they're gone, that is taken away, and they can actually have that peace and, you know, see their child really progress when they're on their own, because they want to do more for themselves. And a lot of times, like all of us, we do a lot for our kids. sometimes with this population of individuals, parents do more.
Sure. Now, do you see this as a precursor to a larger number of ableist-supported medical model homes or medical homes, or do you see this as a template that other nonprofits similar to yours can use to establish this type of facility themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I see it when we had our ribbon cutting and we spoke with the state who is participating with us. They were saying there's now another medical model that will be opening up further north in the state. We have to continue to expand and develop based on the needs of our community members. And I think, you know, it's very possible. It's a lot of work, and there continues to be a workforce shortage. So we were fortunate that we started recruiting for this home 8 months in advance, and it just took that long. And we still actually have additional nursing positions available, but it is definitely something that will expand, I believe, throughout the state.
Excellent. Very good. I don't want to let you go before we take a few minutes, since you mentioned the Birth to Three program, that your holiday gift drive is opened, and this is for families in the early intervention Birth to Three program and adults with disabilities in your life services program. Tell us more about how folks can help your holiday gift drive.
Yes, we have it on our website where people can donate different gifts for individuals that don't have families or don't have the financial needs, the ability to buy certain things. The Birth to Three families are always in need of diapers and wipes. That seems to be something that is always asked for. So we will absolutely collect that and get all those items to the families that are in need.
Very good. And as always, we like to continue to remind people, as our prior guest on today's show has, that you have a ready, willing, and able workforce amongst your clients who are enjoying even greater independence because they have a job.
Yep, that's right. We are always here. And if there are employers that are in need, I can guarantee you that I can make a perfect match and help to fill their needs. We have a lot of people that are able and so dedicated and ready to show up to work every day.
Great. And so what's next for ableists? Wrapping up your 75th year anniversary, your 2025 annual appeal is on. Folks can donate now by going to ableist.us. That's ableist.us. What else is happening? What are you looking forward to for 2026?
Well, our celebration will be April 25th in 2026. So we're just getting that our diamond anniversary celebration started this year, and that will go up until April. And we have our upcoming Sip and Shop our in Glenville. Our Gardens and Gift Center is under renovation, which should be done in February. But our community has been so supportive. We are pivoting to having the Sip and Shop of the products that we sell in our gift store at our 50 Glenville Street site on December 3rd.
Great place for folks to go and not only find some great gift ideas, but also continue to benefit this great cause. 75 years strong, ableist is providing individuals with developmental disabilities and their families with services, supports, and advocacy for building able lives and strong communities. Amy Montemuro is their fearless leader. She's great, a great friend of ours here at the award-winning For the People. We like to chat with her a couple of times a year because their mission is so important and replicated by many other brother and sister organizations across Connecticut. If you'd like to learn more about them, it's ableist.us. Amy, happy holidays. Thank you so much for your good work and your team's good work. And best of luck with your new medical model home and the current holiday gift drive. We'll talk to you again soon. Well, wrapping up our program is actually the second of two bookends to a promise that we made to the New England Rural Health Association back in the spring when they revealed that they were going to be holding their annual conference here in Connecticut. That conference was a few weeks ago down in New London, and we're pleased to welcome back their executive director, Andy Lowe, who also wears a number of other hats, but he is the leader of the New England Rural Health Association, which is providing and improving the health and well-being of rural communities throughout the six New England states, including us here in Connecticut. They're the only regional rural health association in the country enabling the sharing of learning and best practices across these six states. We're going to hear a little bit about some of the high points of the conference, as well as a brand new initiative that they're, or a couple of relatively new initiatives that they're launching. We just want to bring you another critically important piece of public health and safety information, courtesy of our friends at the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection and the Connecticut Fire Academy. They're reminding homeowners to get your chimney cleaned soon, but be wary of scams targeting cleaning and repair services. Since last fall, the Department of Consumer Protection has received almost 50 complaints involving chimney-related services. Some homeowners reported being approached by door-to-door solicitors that are offering a low estimate to fix an urgent structural issue that didn't really exist. So remember, any individual conducting a chimney repair, they have to hold an active home improvement contractor registration through the Department of Consumer Protection. And if you want to verify that the chimney repair company you choose has an active registration, you can search the business name through elicense.ct.gov. All right. Andy, I'm sure tragedies and issues related to chimneys and related appliances are something that is of concern to you guys, too, all over rural New England.
Oh, certainly, John. So many people heat with wood that's certainly an issue. It can be for people that just with oil or things like that. But we do hear of it that this is one of the kind of environmental health or public health issues that kind of, I think, flies a little below the radar for some people. But it is so critical. And one of the things that I think to be aware of is the number of older adults that are heating their homes with wood and who can be prey to some of these unscrupulous kinds of people.
Yeah. Very good. Well, we have already in our prior conversation welcomed the New England Rural Health Association to Connecticut for your annual conference. Let's take 5 minutes to recap the conference and a couple of the high points that came out of it.
Sure, John. We were thrilled to have our largest attendance ever. We had over 400 total attendees this year. We've grown steadily, I think, in the last 5 years from about 250 to now.
It's because everybody wants to come to Connecticut. That's why.
Well, I have to say the last 2 years were record shattering. So Connecticut was certainly a great host state for us.
Great. So once you wrapped it all up and you finally got home and you poured a cold drink or an adult beverage and put your feet up, what was the one thing that really resonated most with you in terms of the presenters or the content or the initiatives that launched or will be coming out of this conference?
Well, certainly the theme was rural health in a changing world, and we know that so many things are going on at the federal level.
Yes.
Recently, one thing that's happened that was probably dominated the discussion more than anything else with everyone I talked to at the conference is the Rural Health Transformation Program. And so quickly, what this involves is that as the one big beautiful budget bill was launched, there was a program that was included in that was called the Rural Health Transformation Program. We sometimes call the RHTP. And that basically is a $50 billion, that's $50 billion with a B, $50 billion program for the next 5 years. And it's going to provide at a minimum of $100 million a year to each state in the country to advance rural health. And there are some very specific guidelines about how the money can be spent. But it's meant to, in some measure, offset some of the cuts that are going to be coming in Medicaid for our rural residents in our various states. So each one of the New England states had about 2 months to prepare an application for this five-year grant. The money is coming from CMS directly to the states. And each state has been doing that. Connecticut submitted their application in the early part of November, just before our conference. And now until December 31st is the date by which the CMS is going to announce the awards. And once that happens, we're expecting in the first part of 2026, the money should start flowing. So the states have all been really rushing to get these applications done. And Connecticut has posted theirs on their website. If anybody Googles Connecticut Rural Health Transformation Program application, you'll get to that link pretty easily. And I have to credit the state of Connecticut. They were very transparent in their process and posted all of the application, including the budget. So this is going to mean there's going to be a lot of money available for the next 5 years going specifically towards rural health, and it'll be able to help the hospitals that serve rural patients, the community health centers and clinics and so on, but a lot more things like workforce help to increase the workforce serving rural areas and so on.
Now, I know the last time our conversation kind of was anchored by mental health, because we ran it in Mental Health Awareness Month, or just after. Is this application in part sanctioning or telegraphing a hope to earmark some of that money toward bolstering mental health services and personnel to deliver it here in Connecticut?
Yes, that's an explicit part of the notice of funding opportunity, or the NOFO, included behavioral health and substance use disorder, and particularly opioid use disorder, as areas to be addressed. So, yeah, those funds can be targeted at increasing the workforce and in strengthening and starting new programs to deal with behavioral health and substance use disorder kinds of issues.
Okay. Just for comparison's sake, I wanted to broaden out the scope of things to try to create some perspective for the listeners. So when we ratchet out your long view across all of New England, we see the states, and Connecticut is the second smallest, but some of the other larger states have vast areas where the rural health service candidates are much fewer and far between. If you could gauge a proportion when you're looking at the state of Connecticut, roughly, what are we talking about in terms of numbers here? Thousands, tens of thousands?
Oh, it's certainly tens of thousands. And I would say it probably gets into probably the low hundreds of thousands. I don't have the numbers at my fingertips. Oh, okay. But one of the things to be aware of is there's a federal definition of rurality as far as healthcare goes. Mm. But the state office of rural health has its own definition. And that's much, much broader than the federal definition. So in Connecticut, there are the primary areas would be the northeastern and northwestern corners of the state. Mm-hmm. But there are areas here and there in between that are, I'll tell you, when I was driving from Vermont down to Mystic for our conference, going on Route 84, Interstate 84, east out of Hartford, and then Route 2.
Yes.
As people know, that it's largely rural that entire way down towards the coast. So there's a lot more than people realize.
Yeah, and rural tracts abutting urban areas, never mind suburban. I mean, just driving from my hometown up in Waterbury down to New Haven, through towns like Bethany and Prospect and Woodbridge, you're going past a number of farms and more sparsely populated places. So that's great to hear that this program is going to have such far-reaching impact to such a large number of folks here in Connecticut. We've got about 4 or 5 more minutes with you, Andy. What were a couple of the other things that came out of that conference that are going to give you either inspiration or traction toward initiatives that you'll hope to take up or improve upon in 2026?
Sure. Before I say that, though, let me just say that you talked about going down through Bethany, which is where I grew up.
Oh, okay. Yes.
So
the home of our rock and rollers from Sonic Youth, right? Bethany, Connecticut.
Yeah. Well, it was really rural when I was growing up. The things that really came out of the conference for me is, first and foremost, was the passion and the connectedness of people from across New England that came together. The sheer volume in the plenary sessions, when you had several hundred people in the same room, was amazing. And these people are talking about rural health, and they're passionate. There has been clearly some erosion of some of the funding and programs in healthcare in recent months, and the enthusiasm and the innovative ways that people are looking to make up the deficit that's coming is really inspiring. Things that are really coming along are certainly a number of the technologies. We had our exhibitor hall was overflowing, and things like AI. There are definitely technologies coming that are going to help. With increasing access to care. At the same time, people are clearly looking at things very carefully, like AI, and so that's going to be certainly a hot topic in coming months and years.
Very good. To close things out, let folks know how they could come to the New England Rural Health Association to learn more about what you're doing here in Connecticut and across our neighboring states.
Sure. The easiest way is our entry is to our website, nerha.org. And there's information there about joining the association. We would love to have people join. We have a list of projects and programs, as well as a number of resources for people. We have a mapping utility where people can get information about rural health disparities across New England, down to the county level, and so on. So, nerha.org is the easiest way. We'd love to have people. Also, they can just sign up for a free profile and get our monthly newsletter, which goes out to our 6,000 mailing list of 6,000 people in our magazine and so on. So love to have people join us that way.
And you are not proprietary to medical and healthcare professionals, right?
We take health as being very broad. It really includes environmental people. We really encourage the business community to get involved, law enforcement, courts. It's certainly behavioral health and physical health, but much more widely, too. Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate your time, Andy, and closing the gap on our promised second visit here. We really appreciate the New England Rural Health Association for considering Connecticut not once, but twice, maybe three times for your annual conference. Glad it went so well, and that you're sharing this important information about how well Connecticut rolled out its application process for this important new rural health transformation program. We look forward to catching up with you again, perhaps in another 5 or 6 months, to hear other ways that the state of Connecticut is using that transformation funding to better the rural health for all of us, not just here in Connecticut, but across New England. Folks, we'll bid farewell now to Andy Lowe, Executive Director of the New England Rural Health Association, that offers a wide variety of member services across all sectors of healthcare professions, stakeholders, and communities, including rural health clinics, critical access hospitals, community health centers, behavioral health and substance use, oral health, dental, social services, community-based organizations, academic institutions, and individuals who are all passionate about rural health. That could be you. Go to NERHA.org to learn more and consider becoming a member of the New England Rural Health Association. Andy, great to hear your voice, and we'll talk to you again in the early summer. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Anytime. Love to talk to you.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.